And good evening and welcome to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston, and I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners. Thank you for all that you do for us here at In His Sign Catholic Radio, both your financial and prayerful support that's kept us on the air for over 40 years and allows us to bring you great shows like today's. Just one quick announcement before we talk to our guest, Dr. Helen Hoffner. Coming up on February 9th to the 11th, there's a Divine Will Retreat that's taking place out at the Malvern Retreat House. It'll be the second one. It'll be directed by Father B. Thomas Celso, who's been a guest of mine a couple of times on the last Wednesday of the month when we have our Divine Will Wednesday. If you have any questions or are interested in making that retreat, you can check out the website at malvernretreat.com or give them a call at 610-644-0400. That's 610-644-0400. And I am happy to be joined today by Dr. Helen Hoffner. She's the author of Catholic Traditions and Treasures, an illustrated encyclopedia, and co-author of the Rosary Collector's Guide. She's been invited to share her research on EWTN, the Catholic Faith Network, Rome TV, and other television and radio outlets. Attended a number of universities here in the local Philadelphia area, where she got her doctorate from Widener, her master's degree from Temple, and a bachelor's degree at Westchester, and has also studied theology at St. Charles Borromeo Seminary. Since 1999, Dr. Hoffner has been a professor at Holy Family University, where she chairs doctoral dissertation committees and teaches graduate and undergraduate courses. She's been a teacher in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia and is a member of the Cardinal O'Hara School Hall of Fame and a Domestic Schools Advisory Board for the Middle States Association of Colleges and Schools. Welcome to the show, Dr. Hoffner. It's great to have you with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And we only had a few seconds to chat before we went live, and I got a copy of the book. It's called Catholicism Everywhere. It's being published by Sophia Institute and will be available at the Sophia Institute. My understanding is that the publication date is still around February 20th. Is that right?
Yes, February 20th.
Very good. So I did check out the website earlier today, and if you go out to sophiainstitute.com, you can pre-order the book. And if you're like me and you like trivia and facts and that kind of thing, especially if you're Catholic, I think this is going to be a great book to get your hands on. I've read through maybe half of it, and the topics in there, many of them I was aware of, and most of them I was not aware of, and just how much the Catholic Church and Catholic individuals throughout history and the impacts that they've had on our world. So what prompted you to make the effort to write the book, Helen?
After I had written the Rosary Collector's Guide and a Catholic Traditions and Treasures book, and I'd be speaking to people at colleges and shrines and churches that I visited, people would ask me about the things that were in those books, but they'd also tell me great little trivia that I didn't know about before. And I was finding just so many interesting facts that I just wanted to compile them so others could really realize all the ways, as you said, that the Catholic faith and members of the Catholic Church have really contributed in medicine and science and just in so many ways.
Yeah, and a number of them touched me directly. For example, I'm a fisherman and had no idea that there was a Catholic priest that had a patent on the spinning fishing reel. And, the various things that the Catholics were involved in, and a lot of them just everyday things that it was interesting to learn about.
And that's fun for us because that priest is from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, so a lot of local trivia.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. One of the ones that struck me early on in the book, you have a whole section that's dedicated to the calendar and the various dates. And, how many of us, even since we were kids, would try to pull pranks on April Fool's Day? And to find out that it actually had its roots, hundreds of years ago, in the changing of the calendar, right?
Yes, when the calendar was changed with Pope Gregory, the date originally had been April 1st. April 1st was the day that the world celebrated a new year. But Pope Gregory thought that the calculations in terms of the solar system and the way things should be, he thought that the calculations were really off. So he had his astronomers recalculate. And then, of course, in the new version, New Year's Day is January 1st. Well, it took a long time for people to accept that. And just as there's protesters today, people protested, and they would insist on celebrating New Year's on April 1st. And, of course, those who did believe that the New Year should start on January 1st called them April Fools.
Yeah, I don't know when, you know, at what point it became a good idea to start pulling pranks, but it is interesting to find out, you know, that the roots were actually something completely different. And that's not unusual, I guess, that, the you know, what we do today was actually started millennium ago, but had a different purpose at the time. And speaking of time...
And even the term double dating came because they had to put two dates down because not every country accepted January 1st right away. There was different dates in different countries, so you had double dating on legal documents.
How about that? But, you know, speaking of time, no idea that, you know, there was actually a monk in a monastery that was behind the development, or the early development, I guess, of the watch.
Yes, and he was someone who actually was kind of a juvenile delinquent, had gotten himself into trouble, and spent some time in a monastery to sort of reform himself, get his mind into where it should be. And while he was doing that, he learned about watchmaking. But at the time, people only had very large watches, we think, or large timepieces like Big Ben. He was able to make it smaller. And one of the very first people to wear a watch like that was a pope. And people marveled that the pope was wearing a clock on his hand.
Yeah, pretty interesting. And it's one of those things that, you know, we all take for granted, probably thought that, you know, watches have been around forever. And, you know, realized that, you know, not only have they not been around forever, but that it was a monk that had a hand in making them. And the other one I got a kick out of was St. Monday. I had never heard of that until you mentioned it in the book. And, you know, the impact that people had in labor relations, if you will, in seeing that people would have off on the weekends for whether they were Jewish or Christian in order to observe the Sabbath. But I was unaware of St. Monday.
And, you know, that's kind of thing that as I was researching it and found these facts, I was having so much fun. It's the kind of thing you want to run and tell somebody, like, look at this neat thing that I learned. But, yes, you know, in the early days, people had off on Sundays, and it was natural for American schools worked on Saturdays. Children thought it was great to have just a half day on Saturday. Children went to school on Saturdays. People worked on Saturdays. And then eventually we got to be more of a diverse and inclusive society and realize that members of the Jewish faith need to have off on their day. Henry Ford was one of the first to give his workers both Saturday and Sunday off. But then I was finding writings from Benjamin Franklin, where Benjamin Franklin talked about when people only had Sundays off. Some people would celebrate a bit too much and maybe hit the pubs too much. And he said people take a St. Monday day off. And St. Monday was their day to recover from their weekend festivities.
Yeah, how about that? I could have used that. You know, we've not met, and I do a show before this one called Saints and Sinners, and being in recovery from alcohol myself, it's one I wish I had back in the day. It would have been great to be able to call in on Monday morning and tell the boss I'm taking off to observe St. Monday. But wasn't aware of it until just the other day when I was going through the book. The second chapter deals with health care. And like I said, we talk a lot about the saints in the previous show. We've been doing that show for 8 years now. So a lot of the saints we've talked about and the work that they've done, whether it was to open hospitals or hospices or the various efforts that they made in the medical field. And I was really happy to see you mention in here Sister Mary Ignatia. I've talked about her from time to time, knowing her as I often call her the third co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, but you give her some space in your book as well.
Oh, yeah, and I think she deserves a great deal of credit for Alcoholics Anonymous being the success that it is. Sister Mary Ignatia was one of the very first people to realize that there could be a medical basis to people that are dealing with alcoholism, and she really saw it as something needing medical treatment. And she was the one to open the very first medical center. She was the registrar of St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio. But she convinced the doctors there to give medical help for people that were dealing with this. So she opened the first wing in her St. Thomas Hospital and then opened another wing in St. Vincent Charity Hospital. And she was very strong and supportive of everything that Dr. Robert Smith, Dr. Bob, who was one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, the two of them really worked together to get people the help that they needed.
Yeah, and you know, those that are familiar know that for years and years, a lot of times they would just be relegated to the sanitarium and not given much hope for recovery. And you know, you mentioned in the book, and I tell the story often about how when you would leave the hospital, she would give you the Sacred Heart badge, forerunner of the token that a lot of us carry in our pocket that are in AA or other 12-step programs. And how you know, we're supposed to give her back. I had heard it said give her back the badge before you drank, but it makes sense as well that you if you did drink, you'd have to give it back to her, and that you know, she would pray for folks that would be in that situation, either tempted to drink again or maybe already have, and that you know, some of them would remain abstinent, which was a great thing. So I was happy to see her in your book. And the one that follows her right after, you know, a lot of us are familiar with the term Alzheimer's disease, but I had no idea where that name came from, and you do a great job of explaining that in the book as well.
It's fun to note there actually was a Dr. Alzheimer, and he started off, he was dealing with a patient who today we would say had dementia. But as you said, in earlier days, people weren't given the respect that they should have. But he dealt with patients who were dealing with some illnesses like that. And he was really the first one to study it and kind of look at medical basis for it. And I think another contribution of the Catholic Church, when Dr. Alzheimer was trying to kind of do some studying, he needed people, anybody who's ever done any research study, you need some subjects, some people to study. He wanted to look at groups of adults and see, was it a difference in diet, was it a difference in lifestyle? And he had the puzzle of, he needed to find a group of people with very similar schedules. And he wound up talking to the Sisters of Notre Dame, because there you could have large groups of women all living in the same household, the same meals, the same schedule, probably using the same doctors. And he's done a lot of research with groups of nuns, and the research has still continued to this day with the Sisters of Notre Dame, studying what might be the different factors.
Yeah, and here we are almost 100 years later, and you know, it's got his name on it, unfortunately or unfortunately. But like you say, good to know that he was a Catholic man, and again, his access to those sisters that volunteered to let him study them and make inroads on the disease. Speaking of roads, the third chapter deals with Catholics on the road, and you know, different people, different families may have different traditions. Some may say a prayer every time they get in the car. Some may say a prayer when they hop in the car to go on vacation. That was one of the ones we had. But a lot of people, when I was younger, would have the St. Christopher medal in the car. And you have a section here carved out saying, is he still a saint? And I know a lot of people, myself included, were under the misconception that he got tossed out of the ranks of sainthood.
No, some of it's a simple numbers game. We only have 365 days in a year. And throughout history, more and more individuals have been declared saints. So eventually you're going to run out of a day for everyone. So we have many saints sharing the same day. St. Christopher was not declared, he was not, as we say, kicked out of the saints. He just doesn't have his own special day anymore. He has to share it with someone.
Yeah. Yeah. And the section to follow that, and for the folks that are listening, as I'm going through and I'm using the table of contents here, because I've looked at some of them, and these are just serving as reminders that I'm only hitting on one or two of these topics in each chapter. There's anywhere from 10 to perhaps 20 in each of these different chapters. So We're definitely not giving away the whole book here, Helen, and I encourage our listeners to go out and pick it up. Again, you can pre-order it. It's Catholicism Everywhere, available from Sophia at sophiainstitute.com. If you go out to their website, you can pre-order it now. If you want to get it from the St. Jude shop locally here in Havertown, you can reach out to them and show your interest, and I'm sure they'll get it either right on or soon after February the 20th. But the next topic that follows St. Christopher was one I was completely unaware of, and that was, and I didn't even know it was a make of card called WASP, W-A-S-P, assuming it's after the B. And they actually had cars that came with the St. Christopher medal already installed?
Yeah, and as far as anyone knows, the only surviving car is in a museum in Vermont. It's in the Bennington Museum in Vermont. But the man who made them, he was not even Catholic himself, but he was a business person, and he had made St. Christopher medals for the Army that were distributed in the Army in the days before we had the separation of church and state that we do with that type of thing. So he had a lot of medals that were left over, and even though he wasn't Catholic, he believed in putting a St. Christopher medal in the car that he drove and the cars for his family members. So when he started his automobile business, and it was called the WASP, which I think is named after the insect also, he insisted that every single WASP automobile had to have a St. Christopher medal on the dashboard. You couldn't say, I don't want it. It was just there. And as I said, they were popular years ago. As far as anyone knows, the only last surviving car is on display at the Bennington Museum.
How about that? I'll have to remember the next time I'm driving through Vermont to make a side trip and check that out. Sounds interesting. The next chapter, Catholics at Sea, I think has a particular interest to those of us here in the Philadelphia area. That's where we broadcast from, just outside Philadelphia, our studios here in Rosemont or Villanova. And I've seen the burial spot of Commodore Barry down at Old St. Mary's in Center City. So you have a section here on sailing in the American Revolution.
Right, and I'm from Delaware County, Pennsylvania, and of course we have the Commodore Barry Bridge.
You
know, a lot of people, they look at John Paul Jones as the father of the American Navy. Actually, there's a lot of research that said Commodore Barry was a Catholic. In fact, he came to the Philadelphia area because he could attend Mass here and he couldn't in other places in the United States at the time. But he was very influential in helping Washington with the Navy, did great things for the American Navy. So our own Commodore Barry Bridge that's in the Philadelphia area is named after a great Catholic who came to the area to practice his faith and then contributed to the Navy.
Very good. And the couple after that, I had no idea that there was a Catholic priest involved in the development of submarines. How does that happen?
Yeah, that's really fun. His name was John P. Holland. He was a Christian brother. His father was in the Coast Guard, so he was always fascinated by the sea. But he had poor health and knew that he could not have a career at the sea because of his health. But as a child, he would draw these pictures of what we would call a submarine, and a lot of people laughed. But he went to a Christian brother school who didn't laugh at him. Because you can imagine in the 1800s, a submarine sounds silly. But he continued drawing them and kept keeping this interest in the sea. He did become a Christian brother, but then later left the brothers. But he started sending his design to the United States Navy, who at first scoffed at the idea. But in 1900, Navy actually contacted him and said, like, what was those ideas you had about a submarine? And the Navy saw that his calculations and his ideas really would work. So the very first submarine, the Holland 6, was commissioned as a submarine in the American Navy in 1900. And we really got the idea of submarines from him, from someone who was a Catholic all his life, a Christian brother for a time. But he gave us submarines.
Yeah, how about that? And then we go from the water to the skies. I'll just mention there's a couple sections in here on things that went on the Titanic. So if you're a Titanic devotee and like those stories, you know, there were Catholics that were involved in saving lives and having Mass and the sacraments on the Titanic. And I guess one of them, I'm not sure where it was. Maybe it's Mass and sacraments on the Titanic, because I was aware of the chapel that we had here in Philadelphia. Most people don't think I get of Philadelphia, I guess, as a maritime city, but because of the Delaware River and the active port that we had or have, that for a long time there was a chapel down on the waterfront that various priests would go out and help with.
Yeah, there's really a lot connected with the sea in Philadelphia. Father Biles, that you were talking about, was one of the priests on the Titanic who said Mass, and some of the survivors actually said that his homily, just by coincidence, mentioned lifeboats the day that the Titanic tragedy happened. He said Mass in the morning, and the tragedy happened closer to like 11 p.m. midnight. But they remember his Mass, and they seem to say that he mentioned lifeboats as like as if God is our lifeboat to heaven, something like that.
Mm. Yeah. So we go from the seas to the skies, and there's only a couple parts here with the skies. I'll leave most of them for folks that buy the book, but one of them that piqued my interest was the first Bishop of the Moon. We actually have a Bishop of the Moon?
We do. In the early days of Columbus and so forth, the policy was that if Columbus' ships set off from Spain, then the bishop of whatever area Columbus was, he was the bishop of the new territory that Columbus discovered. And it was that way in the early days of exploration. Wherever the ship left from, the bishop of that area was the bishop of whatever they discovered in the New World. So in the 60s, when the spaceship landed on the moon, we had the first lunar landing. The bishop there in Florida contacted the Pope and said, well, the ship left from Cape Kennedy here, or Cape Canaveral in Florida, so I am now the first bishop of the moon.
Yeah, how about that? And given not only given the title to yourself, but the idea that we actually had a Bishop of the Moon was pretty interesting to me. The next section that you have, and this is one that you've been involved in for a long, long time, is Catholic education. And we're blessed here in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia not to have as many schools as we used to, but thanks to St. John Neumann. And is the proliferation of parochial schools that we did have throughout the Archdiocese. So this chapter probably means a lot to those that involved in education.
It really is, and as you said, there's so much history of Catholic education in Philadelphia. Some of the fun things, like for people who remember Dick Clark and American Bandstand, West Catholic Girls High School was the closest Catholic high school to where Dick Clark filmed his show. Before it went national, of course, it was at Channel 6 in Philadelphia. So the girls from West Catholic, they would finish their school day and then go on to see the show. But West Catholic made a rule that they were not allowed to appear on camera in their uniforms. For the young people in the audience who've never seen the show, it was a show where they would play music and people would dance and you would see the teenagers dancing. Well, the West Catholic girls wanted to dance on the show, and they didn't have time to leave the high school and get to the studio. They would never make it on time. So the only solution they could come up with was to put a sweater on over their uniform. And they would appear on camera wearing a sweater, like a crew neck sweater, but their Peter Pan collar, their West Catholic blouse, would stick out. So other people watching Dick Clark's Bandstand across the country saw this style of wearing a sweater and the blouse sticking out, and it got to be a fashion trend. And Dick Clark kind of liked it because at the time, rock and roll music was getting a bad reputation. He thought it made rock and roll look kind of wholesome. So he liked the West Catholic girls wearing the sweater of their uniform that way.
Yeah, and my engineer Patrick's here. He's a West Catholic guy, and he's giving a fist bump and talking about how much he enjoyed it as well. Pretty interesting. The other one that's in here is cursive handwriting. And it's something that my wife in particular took great pride in. As a matter of fact, I had gotten something in the mail from somebody who I now know, but she went to grade school with. And when I got the note, this woman mentioned my wife, and so I showed it to her. And my wife's immediate response was, this was the girl who had the best handwriting in school. This is who I wanted to be. This is who I wanted to write like. And I thought it was pretty interesting. And today, I don't even know that people handwrite anymore. I've heard, you know, horror stories about people that see cursive handwriting and have no idea what it is, you know, and can't read it, let alone write it.
And the interesting thing is, handwriting was a thing of the past for a while. Everybody thought, well, in the age of computers, let's not spend time on handwriting. So for a long time, schools weren't teaching it. Catholic schools continued it, but many other non-Catholic schools stopped teaching handwriting so they could get in keyboarding. Catholic schools did keyboarding and cursive. And what strikes me funny is that we think of cursive or Palmer method handwriting as a beautiful, elaborate system. And as I was researching, in the late 1800s, there was a man named Austin Norman Palmer, and he thought that the handwriting of the 1800s was too ornate. All the flourishes and the fancy curlicues, he thought, slowed people down. And Palmer was actually a teacher at a business college. And it was right before typewriters. Typewriters were invented 1874, but they were too expensive for most offices, and there were very few people who were trained in typing. So typewriters came out in 1874, but it took a long time for them to get in offices. So at the time that Palmer was teaching the business college, he was supposed to be teaching adults how to write neatly and efficiently so they could produce a lot of business documents. Well, Palmer thought that the method at the time, Spencerian, was just too fancy. So he simplified it. And he liked his method so much, he started writing magazine articles. And who should read the articles but a group of sisters of the IHM, saw his articles about a new way of handwriting. They contacted him and actually had Palmer come to a summer school in Detroit. This was when the IHMs were in Monroe, Detroit. They hired him to come one summer in the late 1800s and teach 200 nuns that were part of the summer school how to write in his method. And then after the summer school, the Mother Superior said, we like your method, but I can't have a bunch of random newspaper articles or magazine articles. I need a textbook for the schools. So the IHM nuns helped Palmer put his method into a textbook. And then the Palmer method textbook wound up being used in Catholic schools in Detroit and then spread many places. In fact, the IHMs in Detroit split into branches, and one branch came to Philadelphia, one branch came to Scranton. So that's really what put Palmer method in the Philadelphia area the way it is.
Yeah, that's interesting background because elementary school that my wife went to was they had the Mighty Max there, and the parish where I'm involved in now, a lot of the people talk about the Immaculate Heart of Mary sisters that were there and the importance of handwriting. So I knew of the importance that they placed on handwriting, but I didn't know the backstory, and now I do, and so I'm sure that'll be topic of conversation at dinner, probably not tonight because my wife's out for dinner with her girlfriend, but in a coming night I'm sure we'll talk about it. We've managed to get past the bottom of the hour, Helen. We're just going to take a short break to take care of some business, and then we'll be back again. Our guest today is Dr. Helen Hoffner. The book we're talking about is Catholicism Everywhere, published by Sophia Institute and available on February the 20th. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Kathleen McCarthy enhances my life in so many ways. She's a friend, a teacher, and at times, a true spiritual mother. She has the great gift of meeting and loving each person where they are at. My name is Kathy Tierney. After I met Kathleen, I started to listen to her radio programs. In the Silence of My Heart is so special, because the words provoke personal meditation and reflection. It gives gems to think about Jesus' love for me and for each of us. Our Lord then put Kathleen and Father Dermot Roach together when the Holy Spirit is with you. What a match. Wow. The program is an hour, but amazingly it is like a coffee break that flies by. Our Blessed Mother and the Holy Spirit brought us the child Jesus. And Kathleen and Father Dermot bring Jesus the Word to the opening of every program. After the reading of the Holy Gospel, their teaching conversation so stirs your heart and soul, you will know the Holy Spirit is with you.
My friends, it is you who have stood lockstep with us in underpinning our apostolate by your powerful prayers and sacrificial financial giving. We have no doubt that you surely are the angels the Lord said he would send to us, and we are forever grateful. These are urgent times, and we need to proclaim the truth of God's Word, which alone can set us free. And we need to bring the Lord's healing power, love, and mercy out to a world that is in such desperate need. As your local Catholic radio apostolate, we are humbled and mightily blessed to have your loyal support. For our new listeners who would be interested in joining us, we can be reached at 610-527-2906 or on the web at inhissign.com.
And once again, I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners, and thank you for all that you do for us here at In His Sign Catholic Radio. Our guest today is Dr. Helen Hoffner, and she's written a wonderful book called Catholicism Everywhere. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, for those that like trivia and interested in where things came from and what have you, this is a great book to pick up. I'm sure you can share the stories with friends and family, people that you go to church with, and learn quite a bit about why we do some of the things we do, especially as Catholics. Before we went to the break, we were talking about Catholic education and the impact of the Immaculate Heart of Mary nuns on our handwriting, and specifically the Palmer method. The next chapter, Helen, has to do with Catholic fashion. I think we talked about this already with the rock and roll in a plaid jumper. But one of the ones I wasn't aware of was St. Mary and Cope of Molokai, who worked with Damien, I believe. And she was the nun who shopped for pretty dresses.
Yeah, we tend to think that maybe nuns don't think about fashion. But as you said, she was working with Father Damien in leper colonies. And when she was ministering to the people, she saw that the women were wearing just really old clothes. I guess they were so sick that fashion was the furthest thing from their mind. But she saw the way they were dressed, and she thought, there's a thought about when you dress up, you sort of put on a better attitude. She thought that the way that they were wearing these old raggedy clothes wasn't helping them to get better, to just have a better attitude. So she actually insisted on getting pretty dresses for them and did all she could and brought in beautiful dresses instead of them wearing raggedy clothes, maybe not even hospital gowns, but just instead of old clothes, she thought if they were wearing beautiful bright colors, it would lift their spirits and that could contribute to their health.
Yeah, and like you say, it's the little things in life, and something as simple as getting dressed up and looking better, they definitely have an impact on attitude. I think the next chapter, and probably the biggest one in the book, has to do with food. You call it food, fasting, and faith, and all the different topics that are out here. Everything from gluten-free hosts to fish on Friday. To Trappist Ale, and I read a little bit about Trappist Ale, and I was thinking, man, these people are trying to make money off the monks. That's not right.
No, and the monks were smart enough to stop that. They saw that a lot of people were calling things Trappist Ale that really had no connection to the monks or the religion in any way. So they actually went to court and got it copyrighted. And now you cannot call something Trappist Ale unless it meets their guidelines of being done at a monastery, you know, under the presence of the Trappist. So they really put their foot down that people couldn't just use their name.
Yeah, how about that? And then there are a couple here. There's one here, and I think there's one down further, having to do with the Capuchins. You got the Capuchin monkeys, and you got Cappuccino, a gift from the friars.
Yeah, there was a battle, and after the battle, some monks went in, and they discovered some coffee beans, but it was really bitter and extremely strong, so they decided to add some milk to it. And as they were sort of adding milk and playing around with the formula for what they thought was just going to be regular coffee, someone thought it looked like the same shade of brown as the Capuchin monks wore. So that's where we got our name Cappuccino, because it was done there by the monks, and the color resembled the vestments that they wore.
How about that? You know, it's always interesting how things, you know, got their name and where they came from. And when you think about it, it makes sense. But until I had read it in your book, I really had no idea. One of the things in the chapter that would be near and dear to my heart, especially as a radio broadcaster, is Chapter 9, Television and Radio, Broadcasting the Faith. And now I haven't said it, I think, while you're on, but for those that are listening, and we even have people now that watch over Facebook, because we added some video. But, you know, the Catholic Church has been, I think, kind of in the forefront when it came to TV and radio.
It really was. I think when people talk about television, they probably think of Archbishop Fulton Sheen. And actually, in the early days of television, we didn't have certainly the number of stations we have today, but the stations that were around, like NBC, the National Broadcasting Company, they were just thinking, what in the world can they put on TV that would make people want to buy one of these sets? And one of the first things was an Easter Mass, and Fulton Sheen was a narrator. So he sort of laid the groundwork that way.
And you mentioned Wilkes-Barre earlier in relation to one of the other topics. And the first one here, I think it's Religion in the Radio. It was actually the priest from Scranton that was involved in the radio work, radio broadcasts.
Right. The parish, unfortunately, is closed now, but there is still an historical marker in Wilkes-Barre that marks the spot. But there was a Father Joseph Murgus. He was pastor of Sacred Heart Church in Wilkes-Barre. And he was someone who always liked to kind of tinker with things. So Marconi actually did the first radio signal in 1901. But it didn't cover a very wide area, and there were some problems with it. Well, Father Murgus, all the way over in Wilkes-Barre, thought that he could do better. So playing around the base of his rectory, he developed a system that he called a musical tone system, and he could actually send words faster than Marconi could over his system. So Father Murgus got some backers and built one of the very first radio antennas. He had an antenna in Scranton, and then about 19 miles away in Wilkes-Barre, and actually sent the first radio signals that way. He got to be so good at all the work he was doing in radio that he had some of his work patented. And he wound up having 17 patents related to the radio. So here he is working in Pennsylvania. He actually contacted Marconi, who was in Italy. Marconi came from Italy to Pennsylvania to meet with Father Murgus. And Father Murgus gave Marconi his patents without charge, because Father Murgus thought that he was getting on in life. He thought that he didn't have many more years to live, but he wanted radio to be a success. So he gave his patents to Marconi. And then another good thing was that Marconi took those patents back and actually developed Vatican radio that's been around for years. And Marconi was with the Pope when they did the very first broadcast of Vatican radio.
Pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. The next chapter deals with science and Catholicism. And, you know, sometimes as a church we get beat up, and you have the topic in here about Galileo. And just as a side note, I had the fortunate opportunity to travel to Italy over the summer last year. And we stopped in the church there in Florence. And I was surprised to find Galileo was buried there, or entombed there, I should say. Not buried. He's actually, his tomb is in a church in Florence.
Yeah, and he went back and forth in favor. At the time when Copernicus and Galileo were saying that the sun was the center of the solar system, a lot of people didn't agree with that. In fact, the church asked him to sort of tone down what he was saying. There was a lot of controversy. It said that the church never actually said he was wrong. What they wanted Galileo to do was to say that it was a theory. It wasn't proven yet. So for a time, he was sort of in disfavor with the church because he insisted on saying it was fact, and the church wanted him to say it was a theory. But then, way later, John Paul II, in fact, said the church didn't treat Galileo the way they should have, and that he had groundbreaking research that maybe everybody wasn't ready to listen to, and he was sort of forgiven all those years later in John Paul II's time.
Yeah, and the last piece in under science and Catholicism, again, is a topic I hope is near and dear to the people here in the Philadelphia area, even though he's from Italy, originally London, Blessed Carlo Acutis and the Internet. For those that may not be aware, there's a whole section of the McShane Building at the retreat house in Malvern is now dedicated to Blessed Carlo Acutis and the work he did in cataloging and placing on the Internet all the Eucharistic miracles that occurred around the world. How did that end up in your book, Helen?
I was really fortunate because, as you were probably there, in October 1st of this year, Blessed Carlo's mother visited the Malvern Retreat House.
That's right.
So I was able to get there and be sitting out in the grass, you know, hearing her talk. And I just thought, he's such a lesson for everyone. You know, people think teenagers are playing video games on the Internet. And I think Blessed Carlo showed that the Internet could be used to spread the faith. And just his thinking, we all think about websites now, but he was really doing it before websites were as common as they are.
That's right.
So I wanted to really include him as his visionary thinking and a young person doing something really good with the Internet.
Yeah, and what I was surprised, and I probably should have known this, I didn't realize it was only about 11 days from the time he was diagnosed until the time he died. So, he's certainly getting a lot of word spread about him now, especially here in this area. And I encourage all of our listeners, if you get an opportunity, to make a retreat at Malvern, first of all, and then while you're on that retreat, to stop down in Lower McShane and visit the shrine for Blessed Carlo Acutis. The next section is on weather from a Catholic perspective. And the only thing I know about weather in Catholicism is that any time there's something important going on, it's going to occur outside. My mother's putting the Blessed Mother statue in the window. Was there a particular topic in here that you found maybe more interesting than others?
I think St. Elmo's Fire, because I think maybe many of us have heard the song on the radio or the movie, but I didn't know there actually was a weather phenomenon known as St. Elmo's Fire. And that was sailors at sea would see these kind of a glowing ball of lightning that you don't really see over land, but if you're far out at sea, sometimes you would see this type of lightning. And the sailors would get scared, and they would pray to St. Elmo for safety. So when they saw this kind of lightning in the sky, they called it St. Elmo's Fire.
How about that? The next topic, next section, is one I love nature. So God's creatures, great and small. And I was surprised that there's nobody in here or no saints in here that are doing anything with birds. I should have been in your book because I feed birds by hand at my place in the Poconos. But, you know, the various stories, I was aware of St. Francis and the wolf of Gubbio. But perhaps, you know, one or two of your favorites from God's creatures, great and small.
And, you know, maybe there should be a volume, too, because I'm sure there probably are some really great stories about birds. I think the one about God's creatures, it's the idea of the St. Bernard dogs, that there actually were monasteries where the people would stay, and there was a very treacherous, where the monasteries were located, the treacherous through snow and ice were really bad. So pilgrims would go out, and sometimes they would get caught in the snow. And the monks discovered that they sent these big dogs, that the dogs could sort of let them know where people were. The dogs did a lot for them. Sometimes the dogs would sort of plow through and make a path in the snow. The dog's big body would make a path, and then people could follow in the path that they made. Or if travelers were lost, the dogs would sniff them out and come back. So the whole idea of what these dogs did, they wound up being called St. Bernard because St. Bernard was a patron of the monastery right there. And the history books say, you know, we always see paintings of the St. Bernard dog with the keg under his collar. Research can't find any proof that the dogs actually took any ale with them, but the dogs did clear paths for travelers.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have a fond memory of St. Bernard's. My father's cousin owned a bar, and it was my first paying job, I think, was cutting the grass at the bar, and he had a St. Bernard. And unfortunately, I had to clean the yard before I had to cut the grass. And you can just imagine what that was like. We're getting near the end here. And chapter 13 is dedicated to Catholicism in the garden. Talks a lot about different flowers and trees. For those with a green thumb, you'll want to pick this book up in order to see where some of these originated, right?
Yeah, I think the idea of where the different flowers came from, that ladybugs were actually a flower. People prayed to the Blessed Mother because some pests were overcoming their crops, and they prayed to the Blessed Mother, and she sent these little red bugs. So people called them ladybugs because they thought they were a gift from the Blessed Mother to save their gardens.
How about that? I had no idea. I'll be more careful when the ladybugs invade my house again. 14th chapter, sports and recreation, and the first one right off the top, Saint Sebastian. His feast day is actually coming up this Saturday. And when I was a kid, it was a relatively, at least to me, I had not heard of him. But when my kids were in grade school in the 90s, it seemed a confirmation that an awful lot of the kids were taking Sebastian because of athletics.
They really did, and it's, as you said, gotten to be even more popular thing. Simone Biles, a very famous Olympic gymnast, she talks about praying to St. Sebastian before important meets in her life. And she's been known to carry a rosary with her to the Olympics and other events. So she's someone who's a world-renowned athlete who prays to St. Sebastian.
And we've only got about 5 minutes left. And the other topics that are in here include expressing faith through the arts, Catholic weddings, Catholics in the military, Catholic organizations, the Catholic roots of common expressions, and I didn't know where the Hail Mary pass was originated until I took a quick scan through here.
Yeah, that was Roger Staubach in the 1975 playoff game, and he said actually all he was doing was praying for help so that he could help his teammates win the game. He said, I could have said a Glory Be, I could have said an Our Father, I happened to say a Hail Mary, so it became the Hail Mary pass.
Very good. There's also a section in the back with frequently asked questions, and it's not, a whole lot of questions and answers that are there, but one that I found interesting and one that I had to put on my calendar today, as a matter of fact, when I saw it, and that's June 23rd, which is the Feast of John the Baptist, and I didn't know that there was a day set aside in order to burn religious items, and I was given a couple bags of old religious items that can be burnt and should be burnt, and they've been stowed away for a while. And I put on my calendar today that on June 23rd in my fire pit, we will be burning a number of religious items. Where did that originate from? Any idea?
No, really just the thought that the items, you don't want to put them in common trash. Just like we're very careful about what happens to older wine in church, it's a separate way of dealing with that. We don't just put it down a sink. And it's the same thought. We don't want religious items to wind up in common trash. They should be burned respectfully or buried in a place where people are not likely to walk over carelessly.
Amen. And so I thank you for that because it's definitely going to assist me in the bag that I got, multiple bags. There are a couple items in there that will not burn, and so I'll have to locate a space where it says to break them up first into smaller pieces and then bury them, like you said, where people won't be treading on them. So our guest today has been Dr. Helen Hoffner. The book is called Catholicism Everywhere. It's published by Sophia Institute, available for pre-order right now on sophiainstitute.com. Should be available come February 20th. If you want to purchase it from the St. Jude shop in Havertown, I would call them and let them know that you have an interest, and they will probably either have it in stock on February 20th or shortly after. Helen, I'll give you an opportunity. Is there any particular topics that you wanted to mention that I didn't cover?
I think the ones that a lot of my friends are having fun with is that coffee was almost outlawed. In the 16th century, world leaders thought that coffee was addictive, and they asked the Pope to ban it. But the Pope took a sip and decided that, no, coffee was an acceptable drink for all Christians. So we've got Pope Clement VIII to thank for letting us have coffee.
And thank God for that. I think caffeine may be addictive, but sometimes I wonder if I drink it for the taste or for the effect. And many times it's both, but good to know. And thank you, Pope Clement, for that. Again, our guest today has been Dr. Helen Hoffner. The book we've been talking about is called Catholicism Everywhere, again, published by Sophia Institute and available at their website at sophiainstitute.com. And locally here at the St. Jude shop, try to use those two sources before any of the other online retailers. Dr. Hoffner, I can't thank you enough for being with us for the whole hour. I'm sure we learned a lot, and I can tell our listeners that it's only a very small fraction of what you'll learn when you pick this book up. So thank you again for being with us, and good to know you're right here in our backyard as well up there at Holy Family. So thanks.
It's my pleasure. I love sharing good Catholic news.
Very good. We'll look for, you know, one quick question. With the book that you participated in on rosaries, is that still available? And is that just the history of the rosary, perhaps, and the rosaries that have been available over the centuries?
It has some history, but the main part of it is rosaries that are approved by the Catholic Church. Like the Lasso Rosary, that's not as popular in Pennsylvania, but in Texas, New Mexico, a very popular type of rosary for weddings. It's rosaries that, in addition to the traditional five-decade rosary, all different variations that are approved by the Catholic Church that maybe are not common knowledge.
Very good. So I'm sure you can look that one up as well. So, again, Doctor, thanks for being with us, and good luck in all that you do. Take care, and God bless.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So I was fortunate enough to get an advanced e-copy of the book. It not the finalized version, and so obviously not, and not that I would anyway, not shareable. But this is one that I think you can have some fun with if you keep it on the coffee table or nearby when you have friends or family or company over, and you want to talk about anything Catholic. There'll be plenty of things in here to generate conversation, that's for certain. Again, this has been a great day, different experience, once again, doing this over Facebook Live and having to be aware of video in addition to the audio, and a great trend, I think, in what we're seeing throughout the broadcasting world, whether it's Facebook Live or other types of podcasts. And, you know, once again, the crazy world of ours seems to be getting crazier and crazier by the day. These reminders that we get, like in Dr. Hoffner's book, of the importance of our Catholic faith, and not just in great matters, but all the small matters and the role that our church has played throughout all of history. And I think the role that it's going to play in the years and definitely the decades to come. Not sure how much longer God's going to put up with the likes of us doing the things that we're doing, and not we as in me and our listeners, but we in the larger sense of this this planet Earth and what's going on. So now more than ever is the time for prayer, daily Mass, frequent confession, I was listening to a priest on my way up on another podcast, and you know, talking about, you know, the instruction people might be receiving that, you know, you don't have to go to confession necessarily unless you're in a state of mortal sin. And I just think of how great that sacrament has been for me, and to only go once a year and to deny ourselves of the grace that's available in that sacrament is sinful, you know, to know that it's available and that we can go, even if it is just for venial sin, the grace that we can get, and we can never get enough of it, that, you know, should make us want to go as often as we can. Daily Mass, if you can, if not, at least, you know, once more during the week, and respond to our Blessed Mother's call, whether it's at Medjugorje or other apparitions, you know, the call to prayer and fasting, and that would include the Sacrament of Confession, certainly, and frequent attendance at Mass, if you can. So once again, I want to thank all of you for being with us for whatever part of the 2 hours you could join us, and I look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. Until then, I pray that God will hold you in the palm of his hand. Take care, and God bless.